Welcome to Blind Shovel, an arts and music podcast. Today I speak with illustrator Pete Gamblin. Hope you enjoy. Yo.
All good?
Yeah.
Are you good to proceed?
I am prepared to proceed.
Or are you shook by what you just
Well, I mean, I am fairly shook, as the kids say. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of when you reached out before Christmas about doing this interview, I was pretty shook then too, which is kind of why I demurred at the time. But the shooketh-ness continues and will be continuing for the foreseeable future. So everything else has to continue in the meantime.
Okay. Understood. So what have you been up to?
Well, today I was doing my taxes.
Wow.
It kind of every year I email my accountant around this time, and I'm like, so sorry for the delay in getting in contact this year. I promise that I'll get my shit in order in February next year, and every year it just gets slightly later. But I guess that's just the kind of procedure.
You have an accountant. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've been using this lady for a long time, and when I first started using her, it was right after Sandy, and I went down to her. She invited me down to meet her at her house, which was just a block or two from the boardwalk in Coney Island, and they, you know, everyone had had a lot of damage. And she was telling me about how her daughter was currently on a gap year in Europe. And now it's been 12 years later, and it remains pretty affordable. And I haven't gotten audited yet, so I'm taking that as a good sign.
Do you want to talk about being a freelance illustrator in taxes?
Apparently.
Is that a...
Well, it's what the kids need to hear.
What did you expect? How is taxation different than you imagined as a freelance illustrator?
I mean, I think I imagined nothing.
Sure.
I mean,
well, you probably imagine it would be pretty bad, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like ever since I showed up on planet Earth, I've been imagining that things were going to be pretty bad. So that's more or less been borne out. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is kind of funny. I do feel like my education involved zero practicalities. Which is fine, and I think probably standard. But it is, I don't know, it is a pretty big part of it.
Did you go to school in America or England? I don't recall.
No, England. I went to Brighton. At the time, it was kind of, I think, one of the better courses for illustration in the UK. I'm not really sure of the current rankings in that particular horse race.
And you went for illustration?
Yeah.
And then you said, I have to move to New York City. It must happen.
I suppose kind of. I mean, I think I'd kind of... I think the first kind of 19 or 20 years of my life were kind of like a semi-conscious drift towards a particular objective. And then once I achieved that, I was then free to drift off in new directions. But yeah, being an illustrator was something that I kind of realized was an option in very small increments. And then, I'd always been pretty interested in living in the States, and once I made it happen, I was then able to kind of free up my mind to think about other things.
That's cool. Yeah, I've never been to England, and I don't know what it would be like, I have no fantasy about it. And it's like we're very similar but different. So what was that fantasy? What did you imagine you would find here?
I mean, it's quite hard to say at this point. I do think that a lot of, I think there's like a very like longstanding and kind of persistent sort of like cultural myth about America in England and Europe. I feel like whether it's kind of, I mean, when I grew up, I read a lot of Tintin comics, and I feel like Tintin in America had a pretty big visual impact on me when I was a kid. There's this one panel where Tintin's clinging to the like bricks of a Chicago hotel room, and it's like truly an amazing perspective drawing, kind of like disappearing down into nothingness of all these, horizon lines of brickwork. And I feel like that must have done something to my brain, both in terms of drawing habits and also maybe I imagine myself clinging to that window ledge one day.
So you're all about the bricks.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it shows, at least, well, maybe it used to show in my work. I feel like I maybe draw brickwork a little less obsessively now, but I did make a whole zine about it at one point.
Well, are you disappointed in the lack of bricks?
No, there's plenty of bricks for my
I feel like there's a good amount of bricks.
There's plenty of bricks for my liking, but I just think my horizons have broadened a little bit since I was 5 years old, thank God.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm trying to get that stone, but there's not a lot of stone around here.
Yeah, I mean, stone is also fun to draw. I don't know if you've ever spent time studying a dry stone wall, but, you know, the creation of it is an art in of itself, and also you can really get lost in looking at all the joins.
No, I don't think I've done that. I don't use reference for almost anything. I'm beginning to think I should sometimes at 35. Maybe I should, look at some visual reference while drawing.
I actually just had a very funny experience earlier today that made me think about reference. I was, there's a little Polish delicatessen not too far from my apartment. And there was like an older guy in line ahead of me, kind of like real like jittery energy. He was kind of, you know when you encounter someone in the street who really thinks that they're kind of sort of like a man about town kind of flaner type?
I don't know if I know that, but keep going.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
I'm trying to follow this thread.
This guy was pretty agitated. He is kind of like hopping from one leg to another and, rap back and forth with the Polish counter guys, drop what few Polish or Russian words that he knew, which mostly seemed to be vodka. But anyway, he'd given one of the guys behind the counter a drawing, and it was like a woman's head at an angle wearing a baseball hat with the name of the deli on it. And then there's this strange kind of like dog horse creature in one side of the drawing is like drawn in Sharpie on like a piece of letter paper. I was like, oh, that's kind of a fucking insane drawing to see. And then as he was waiting for his meat to be sliced, he was drawing again on his pad and he produced another drawing that was kind of almost exactly the same. And, it was like pretty outsidery, but you could tell he had like some sort of like artistic capability. But it was the drawing was ostensibly the staff behind the counter, but it was exactly the same as the first drawing and didn't look anything like anyone who worked behind the counter. And it was just kind of interesting to see someone drawing what they thought they were seeing in front of them. But they were clearly taking no reference whatsoever.
Oh yeah. I had this funny idea once that it would be cool if people could only see
to the degree to which they could draw.
Oh my God.
Like, that's like the way they would transmit. But I don't know. I think, do you use reference? I mean, you're looking at stone walls. I know that.
I don't think I really, I think the last time I used reference was a steam train for a Bloomberg illustration. And I don't know. I mean, I spent a lot of time in like plane and car museums when I was a kid. So I feel like a lot of mechanical stuff like that is kind of have a pretty good conception of it in my brain.
Well, you have a very full use.
Yeah, thanks.
Bricks, museums.
Yeah.
Tintin.
Yeah, I mean, a European childhood that perhaps doesn't exist anymore. But I don't know. I mean, definitely kind of growing up pretty visually drawn to the kind of detritus of the 20th century.
Were you drawing a lot as a young child?
Definitely. Unfortunately, it was a lot of tanks and bombs, but I was definitely drawing a lot.
I mean, that's fun to draw.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know. I like, I look back and I'm like, I don't know. I wonder who I would have been if I'd been drawing flowers instead.
At age 5?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know
if you'd end up much different. It's not like you went into bombing.
No, maybe I would have. Maybe I would have been like, you know, let's chuck all this botany in the trash and take up systematic violence.
Yeah, I'd like to see more bombs. And I mean, you got to have some illustrations with bombs and tanks, no?
I think so. I mean, you know, occasionally, you know, like a times piece will come up where... Well, actually, I guess it was last year I did a drawing for the Times that really was really kind of like drawing on my childhood experience, because it was about the U.S.-China kind of arms race in the Pacific. And we ended up, me and the art director ended up deciding on drawing all these like tiny little tanks going around the edge of the page. It was kind of like a full back page, I think. So it was really kind of, I was thinking about back to being a kid, and I was like, wow, I've kind of been preparing my whole life for this assignment.
Do you live in the basement of the New York Times?
Thankfully, I don't. Thankfully, I live in an apartment that has windows on three sides, which is, I think, about as far as you can get from the basement in New York.
Do you like being informed?
Do I like being informed?
Yeah, like, do you like doing articles that contain news? Do you like being an editorial illustrator? Because like I didn't like that in my brief foray, but that's just not what I'm into. And fortunately, most of the times I was just pushed into like some weird narrative illustration, even if it was editorial. But
yeah,
is that a?
I mean, I don't like being informed as much as I used to be. I don't know. I feel like I used to kind of. There was definitely a point when I was younger, when I was getting more of like a, when I was getting kind of more juice out of the being in service to the news cycle. But you know, then I kind of grew up a little more.
Well, I kind of ask because how do I word this without
without being insulting?
Yeah.
Well, I feel like you're about to rephrase the question that you asked me the last time that we spoke, saw each other in person, which was, why are you still doing this?
I think that is, maybe I've gained some tact since then, but I think the question is related to the fact that editorial is often the first thing you do coming out of school.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't always imply that that's like, oh, that's really what that person likes to do. But if you've been doing it for how long?
About 13 years.
Then it implies something. At the very least, stylistically it fits, or you like that kind of format, or it pays the bills. Editorial is really interesting to me because... some teachers I had in illustration just went super deep into it. You know, it's like their whole career.
It seems like our generation can sometimes manage a more varied diet, I guess you could say, because of social media, they get opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's the cornerstone of, I assume, your financial situation, right?
Yeah. I mean, roughly. I mean, you know, I do feel, I mean, as far as the internet goes, I'm extremely bad at sharing the work that I do. And I think in the editorial stuff is, it's pretty easy to do because you do it and it comes out the next day and then you remember to post it. Whereas projects that you maybe spend a couple of months on and then come out like a month or two later, you kind of forget to post them. And also, I don't know, I do feel so far as sharing stuff on the internet, it's, I mean, I think thankfully there's a lot less reward for doing so than there used to be. So it kind of forms, I don't know, I do feel like I kind of, there's a lot of stuff that I kind of maybe I'm not visibly doing because I don't share on the internet. But, but I mean, so far as it may, as so far as the kind of place it holds in my career, I mean, I do think when I first started out, it felt like pretty gratifying. And then, I don't know, I mean, knowing that we were going to talk about illustration, you know, I was like, you know, turning certain things over in my mind. And I do think I'm pretty kind of, I do think the way my brain works is pretty suited to kind of like creating kind of momentary kind of passing images, which is the nature of editorial. I mean, it's not precious and it's not important, but it is kind of diverting. And there was definitely a point, I mean, maybe like 10 or 11 years ago, that I really thought that I was going to start producing comics. And I really, I don't know, I feel like at that point, I felt like I was felt very inspired and really excited about a lot of what was happening in like independent comics. And I kind of thought, oh, like, I love this. I should do this. And I just kept not doing it. And eventually I had the revelation that, well, if I'm not doing it, it's probably because I don't actually want to do it. I just don't, you know, I do think that kind of, I do think that the way my brain works is best when it's producing something kind of easily digestible. And I mean, there was definitely a point at which I used to, you know, quote unquote, be more self-expressive through drawing. And I kind of don't really do that anymore because I have kind of other outlets and channels for that. And that has helped kind of, I think, help me understand what I'm better at in terms of drawing, which is kind of producing pretty kind of like finite, digestible, diverting images that are then kind of lost in the shuffle.
Interesting. Yeah, there's an honesty about that in the sense of, well, I mean, yeah, I think about that all the time now with the, I guess it's so, everything's so throwaway. It's that's no controversial statement. People scroll past images quickly and people probably don't look very hard at illustrations. And I suppose that's why I always liked books, because there was at least some gravity to them, literally.
Yeah.
Because, okay. Yeah. Okay. At least, you know, comics, I do believe people like to see sacrifice, human sacrifice. So they're just like, okay, this is a giant thing. It probably took really long.
Yeah.
I'm a little more interested in what's going on here. And I'm not certain you're not meant to make comics because you hadn't made them yet. They're just a pain in the ass, you know?
They are a pain in the ass. And I mean, certainly I agree with you that I think people respond well to sacrifice. I think when someone can tell that you've ruined your life for several years to make something, they're like, oh, great. Mm-hmm. And then they move on.
They pause. They pause a little longer.
Yeah.
They pause a tad longer.
Yeah. You've just finished a pretty monumental undertaking. So I feel like you're probably grappling with how to kind of be like, hey, I've spent years making this book. This is worth more than one moment of your passing attention, you know?
Yeah, I'm don't tell anyone, but I'm not done yet.
I
approach this so differently because my life is so different and I can't enter what the kids call the flow state anymore. I don't even know if I buy that stuff. Maybe I can, and quickly, because I feel like illustration does get you into this practice of being able to jump in and out really quick and get a point across, get an image across.
Yeah.
And it's really unromantic, and I value that more and more, where it's just like work. I used to not like the idea, but I just kind of would chisel it off, like just 1 hour a day kind of thing, trying to find time. Very adult, instead of getting lost in 8 hours of reverie and then producing 1 hour of actual work, you know? But I do find also with comics, at least the way I started them, it might just be that you haven't found the particular system that works yet. And it isn't clear how to start a comic when you haven't done it yet, or what it should be. Should you write a script? Like, if you want to make Tintin, sure, there's probably a way you got to go about that. But maybe Peter's comics are not that. And maybe they're more chopped up. Maybe there's ways to pull images you already have on the back burner and try to connect them in ways that are appealing to you. But it does beg the question, when you're our age, what are you doing? And when I was like 20 something, I wasn't really asking that question, but I know every person in my family was asking that question about me.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of beautiful obliviousness to that, but also it's kind of leads to a dead end, if I'm being completely honest. So there's a lot of juggling one must do. And obviously there's life. So the way all those things meet each other is fascinating, and obviously that's why I like talking to artists, because they're not just factories of images or content, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're definitely right. And I mean, like, the point at which I felt like I was like having this wrestle, this internal kind of like wrestling where I wanted to make comics and kind of be part of that community, and yet was unable to kind of like consistently commit to producing things. I mean, I started like a lot of different strips and kind of ended them and did like a lot of one pages and stuff. But it was also a point at which I was, I feel like the physical way in which you do it is like really important. And at that point I was drawing with a number two sable brush and like a pot of ink, which meant that I would be taking hours to do a few panels because, you know, I was putting the ink on incredibly thick and then had to like just literally sit there and watch it dry. And, you know, I would like put my angle poise lamp down low to try to get the heat from the lamp to dry it faster. But I kind of really realized at a certain point that I was just kind of wasting my time in a very literal sense with the physical tools that I was using. And that's kind of when I started using pens more. And I mean, I use a rapidograph now, and it was recently it broke and I had to get a new one. And there's like a job that I had to do while the new one arrived, because you can't even buy them in New York. I mean, I've been around all the stores and you can't buy them. But I had to do a job with a mixture of like a dip pen and some microns. And it took me like 3 or 4 hours longer to do than it would have otherwise. And it was kind of just like, it was kind of like a horrible reminder of how inefficient I used to be, and how in a real way that inefficiency was like preventing me from making the things that I was attempting to make.
Yeah, there's a lot of friction. A lot of different kinds of friction, yeah. Mental, physical, et cetera. And you have to figure out which friction is romantic enough to keep around.
100%.
And it's like, after I'm done with this book, I really hope to not draw on a tablet for some time.
Yeah.
I just ended up there via, I mean, I'm no victim, but doing illustration just kind of slowly pushed me into these efficiency modes that I then adopted for my personal work in comics that I haven't shook.
Yeah.
All the time, you know, it's like half and half, but now I'm in this mode of AI is going to saturate the world so much so, and I want my grandkids or whatever to be like, I don't even think they'll believe that we made drawings by hand. And so I want that paper.
Yeah.
I want that stack of a yellow paper.
Yeah. You want that fire hazard.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It is. I do feel like I know a lot of people who've kind of like ended up working exclusively digitally, who are very productive, and that is kind of like the key to it. But you know, there's some exceptions. I mean, and when it comes to friction, I feel like I like to keep things pretty low tech. I mean, you know, I draw with pen and paper and pencil and scan, and then just do very simple color in Photoshop. And I'm still running CS6 because I refuse to join Creative Cloud because I don't want to be on hooked up to that chain for the rest of my life. But I don't know.
It's a gateway drug, coloring.
Yeah,
that's how I got in there. I just used to do the line work and then color it. And comics, it's also the question is, what is the actual? It's not like you're making original art. You're making a reproduced object in the first place. So it has a mechanical nature to begin with. It's not a precious thing.
I mean, that's true. But there is also, I mean, you know, if we're going to talk about, the financial side of things as well. I mean, my friend Brian is a comics artist, and you know, like he makes drawings that become books and t-shirts and all that sort of thing. But there is also like a pretty big appetite for his originals, and he just had a show in France of his originals, and like that is also like a pretty big avenue for him to kind of like make money from the work that he's already done. And you know, if you're drawing everything in an iPad or something and people actually like the drawings, you can't sell that drawing to somebody. You can't frame it, you can't, you know, sign it, you can't do nothing with it except print it out. And I think it's selective, obviously, but there is an appetite out there for
No, I feel you. Absolutely. The original drawing.
Yeah.
100%. There's no doubt about it. So you got to balance all these things, and oftentimes that just ends up with intuition pushing oneself in one direction or the other.
Yeah, I mean, you can't fight intuition.
You can try. I don't know what the outcome of that is. But the other issue is when you sit down to make a comic, you're not only forced to look in the mirror as to your own self-expression's depth, but then you have to consider the time it takes. So making a, you know, painting is one thing, but making 1,000 of them and putting them in the book, you really have to, I don't know why, but I feel like in your 30s you start to be a little more like, why am I doing this? Whereas in the 20s it almost seems like it's an inevitability. So I can imagine an illustration pairs strangely with that, because you get used to being of service to others, if I'm putting it nicely.
If you were putting it unnicely, would a word begin with W enter the conversation, possibly be four letters and with an O in the middle?
Well, I guess it depends how much autonomy and integrity you have in the process, right? There's some illustrators that really handle themselves well, and it's a skill. But it's a different skill set. So when you were, I know you mentioned this earlier, and I assume you mean music is kind of filling that space, but in terms of self-expression, what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, definitely music and songwriting. And that's funny because that's also another area where I've chosen to perpetuate a lot of kind of friction in the production of that. I have this 8-track reel-to-reel that I record a lot of music on, which I need to service at least once a year, which involves going down to Maze Landing in the absolute bottom end of New Jersey below Atlantic City. And it's kind of like the guy down there is he used to run Tascam, which is the manufacturer of these tape machines. He used to run their North American repair division, and now he kind of just does is more or less retired, but he kind of still repairs them out of a storage locker down there. And, you know, he's aging, the machines are aging, the parts aren't available. And every time something breaks on this thing, it really is a question of is this going to be fixable? And
yeah, that's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it is. And there is, I don't know, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of pleasure from kind of making things, whether it's music, art, whatever, in a medium where there's a physical interaction, whether, you know, you're moving knobs on a fader or trying to kind of juggle a cable so it stops fucking shorting out, or, you know, trying to use a pen that they suddenly stop making cartridges for. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's two paths, and one of them, you try to kind of stay current, and, you know, you try to kind of anticipate change and kind of get ahead of it. You know, you kind of work digitally, you kind of license your art, you kind of submit yourself for AI modeling, and, you know, license your images to stock websites and all that sort of thing, and try to have some sort of control over the larger tech changes happening around you. And the other way is to just be okay, I like drawing. Part of the thing I like about it is not looking at a computer. I just have a piece of paper in front of my face, and I'm going to keep doing that until
I die.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've been served a kind of relieving dynamic in the sense that I feel that the former, the one of keeping up, etc., is an impossibility even at 35.
Oh, totally. It's completely over.
So we can rest easy.
Yeah.
We don't need to be sexy anymore. We don't need to stay with it.
Yeah.
It's just you got 60, maybe 56 years if you're healthy of just really digging deeply into that craft and then dying. And that's kind of relieving in some sense. You know that there's little 12-year-olds AI prompting like nobody's business, and they're coming for you. And
yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, the iPad babies, let them do what they will. It's none of my business. Yeah.
But that's relieving because we might as well be a 120 years old at this point in respect to our proximity towards, I don't know how you would word it, but the stream, the fashion stream.
Yeah.
And that's only going to increase. So I don't know what, you know, does that make you want to just go back to crumpets?
No, it doesn't make me want to go back to crumpets. I mean,
I don't know what crumpets are.
Crumpets are a state of mind. A crumpet is a delightful confection that is just as full of holes as it is full of substance. But
like nooks and crannies.
The nooks and the crannies that you've heard so much about.
Like an English muffin.
Yeah, but more so. I mean, these crannies are deep, chimneys.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if you like an English muffin, the crumpet is kind of the crack to the muffin's cocaine.
Cocaine, okay. Yeah. And can you get a crumpet in Manhattan?
I haven't tried. I mean, I tend not to. I mean, there is a funny little store in the West Village. I forget what it's called, but it sells British specialties. And I
was going to ask what that is. Yeah, what is that?
I can't remember the name of it. It's
no, just what's British? What is British cuisine?
strong mustard. Okay. Certain cookies, to use the American phrase, and a lot of mashed potato. And you know, it's people like to laugh at it, but it's some of it's pretty damn good. It's just, I mean, at its best, it's very hearty and warm and nourishing. But you know, some of the stereotypes about incredible blandness do hold true too.
I only mentioned it and thought of it because of, like you said, the warmth of the crumpet versus the coldness of AI. No, I just imagine.
I'm sure AI could render a crumpet with a horrifying amount of holes. There's the what's the name of the phobia? I think it's trypophobia or something, where it's like people who are intensely disgusted by lotus root and anything that has like a lot of holes in it.
No, I don't know about that one.
I think it's tryptophobia or something like that, but it's like a real like gut aversion to that. And I think I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like when AI images first started proliferating, a lot of them would make me feel really physically ill.
Yeah.
Like I had very like visceral reaction to them. And like that,
the videos especially.
Yeah.
Make me nauseous for up to 2 minutes, I feel.
Yeah, no, that's lessened with exposure, which I don't think is a good thing. Earlier today I saw a funny I saw a funny post from a heavy metal account where I was warning people of AI heavy metal art. It was like, these are, you know, it's like bands buying art that they don't realize is AI. And it was kind of going through all these like generated images and kind of like showing people like ways to spot them. And there was some fantastic wording in it. It was like talking about how, you know, the hands are bad, but then it also said, watch out for unintelligible horns.
Unintelligible horns.
I know. It's just like, I like that phrase just, I feel like made me think about so much, you know. It immediately made me think of music, you know. What would a song featuring unintelligible horns sound like? I mean, maybe John Zorn, but it was just that phrase really cracked me up.
That's a good one. But yeah, do you imagine how long you think you'll live?
Yeah, I mean,
can you imagine it?
I think when I don't know. I mean, the future is so fucking horrifying and so bleak, and it feels, you know, when you think about the future, you're like, wow, you hope that you live long enough to still be kind of pretty physically healthy, but not long enough to see the worst that's going to come.
That's the combination you're looking for?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I want to get
the sweet spot.
I want to get my stuff done, but there's certain abject horrors that I would prefer not to rest my gaze upon.
Do you imagine, you know, I don't know, suddenly I'm imagining, this is not a fantasy I have. You know, I'm like old and I'm in an English cottage. but there's like,
yeah, I mean,
robots and stuff also.
I don't know. I mean,
where can you retreat? You already left England.
I mean, I don't really think retreat is possible. I don't think there's, I don't think there's like a physical safe haven anywhere. I've always kind of loved seeing like, you know, really old New York people. Like, you'll see someone in the Met and it's like a guy who looks about like 145, like bend double, with a bucket hat and like a giant tie and a tote bag, just like a walking right angle looking at the art. And I've always kind of thought, you know, that'd be a pretty good place to end up.
Okay.
But
modest goals.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, really, I just want to stick around long enough to get my stuff done. And
that's a good point. So what's the stuff? You do a lot of different things. So can you think of one thing that is the apex of your career output at this moment?
Well, I do feel very proud of a record that I put out a few months ago that I made with my friends Tim and Ezra. We started making it maybe around two and a half years ago. I guess a little over 2 years ago. And
what's that called?
It's called A Deeper Blue. The band name is Shut-Ins, and if you look it up on streaming, there's two dashes to avoid it being confused with some other losers also with the same band name. But I do feel pretty good about that. It took a long time, and it was like the sort of project where you kind of think halfway through that you'll never ever finish it, and also that it's not worth finishing, and that, you know, you should kill yourself. But once I was done,
it's interesting you went to music. I wasn't talking specifically about music, but is that just where you go naturally?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, you asked me what kind of project felt like a creative apex, and I think it probably is that one.
Were you also very interested in music as a young lad?
Yeah, I was, but then I kind of took a break for quite a while. I had had guitar lessons when I was a kid and played with my friends in a heinous punk band when we were teenagers. And then I kind of like deliberately set it aside to focus on drawing when I was like 17. And then kind of started playing music again when I was like maybe 27 or 28. So I kind of really missed the window where I could have like had some self-deception about it becoming more than anything else. So it's really just, returning to it has just been like, oh, this is this niche hobby that I'm going to pour my life's blood into. But there's not going to be anything else to it apart from doing it and having my relationship with it.
Why do you think you chose to double down on art as opposed to music? Were you simply more naturally inclined?
Yeah, I think when I was a teenager, I think making music seemed more incomprehensible to me. Like, I think I didn't really have any conception about the possibilities of making music by myself. I didn't really have the conception of kind of like home recording. And I also didn't really have any sort of real positive reinforcement around it from like any peers, whereas drawing was very like tangible to me, you know. Like, it's like when I was 17, it felt much easier to kind of conceptualize doing a whole piece of art by myself than it was to make a whole piece of music by myself.
Is that related to the fact that you need other people to make music?
I mean, you don't actually, but...
Or you don't?
It can be nice. I mean, I don't know. I play in a band with two of my friends, and then there's the other band Shut-Ins that has been kind of like, that's kind of like a, sometimes I've made that with two other friends and sometimes I've made that stuff by myself, and it is, I don't know, it's very kind of rewarding and consuming, just to kind of, I don't know, I feel like, I don't know. It's the, you know, you were talking about like kind of like a flow state earlier. And I find it's much easier to enter that with music than it is with drawing.
Yeah, there is that interesting dynamic between what one is good at and what they love to do, and they're not always the same thing, or they go in waves on both, you know.
Definitely.
Metrics. Yeah. So it's good to have both. I mean, it's nice that you have. Do you write poems secretly as well?
Not really. I mean, when Clay and Liana were publishing The Smudge, you know, I had like drawings and writing in all of those, you know, in every issue. And that was more of a glib approach to incorporating poetry into drawing. But that was satisfying. But towards the end, I felt like I was kind of repeating myself, or kind of, I needed to kind of, that kind of particular thing had kind of run its course for me a little bit.
So The Smudge doesn't get, it doesn't exist anymore, no?
No. I mean, they stopped publishing that a couple of years ago now.
I'm quite out of it, but I'm trying to kind of understand. You know Vinny, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
You and him are like a similar archetype, right?
Yeah, we are.
Like there's some kind of ethic here that is interesting, of a scene of illustrators who can't accept just being illustrators.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's
any... Which is good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... It's like, it's hard to even conceptualize... There would be some outside pressure that we should only do that. But it is, I mean, it is funny because I feel like, and I think Vinny and I probably feel pretty similarly to this, you know, you have a certain kind of like perception of, you know, other people have a certain perception of yourself based on this one thing that you do. And then if you start doing this other thing, it's like, oh, you're an illustrator who makes music, and it's like, somehow like illustration music in some regard, which I think feels like a certain kind of preeminence in one area kind of invalidates people engaging with the other in like a more sincere way, which is actually why it's incredibly hard to make any art for the music that I make, because I really don't want to do a drawing for it, because I don't think my songs sound like my drawings.
Interesting point. So what's the solution to that? I see some of these covers, they tend to lean on photography.
Yeah, I mean, I've done like some collage stuff and some type-based stuff, and I mean, some drawings when it felt like the right thing. I do think, you know, I think musicians recognize that it's hard to make art for music, which is why they go outside of themselves to, make artists do the hard work for them. And I think for me, I'm like, well, Jesus Christ, both of these things are incredibly fucking difficult and have almost no relationship to each other, but I do need to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. You must.
The algorithm demands it.
I mean, this pizza box. I thought maybe you were going to say the pizza box.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
That's pretty good.
If you wanted to talk strictly illustration stuff, then that would be a pretty high point, I think.
Is it good pizza?
I never ate it.
Oh, I mean. What?
Look pretty good in the photographs. I mean, I don't know.
So you illustrated a pizza place without eating the pizza?
I mean, I don't think I could have billed the client to fly out to San Francisco to sample his wares.
Well, I think you could have.
Yeah. No, that was a nice project. That felt good. But, I mean, you know, to think about, like, the illustration projects that I'm proud of. I mean, I feel like there's plenty of stuff, but they occupy, like, once they're done, they just kind of disappear in my brain. And I'd really have to start looking through my flat file to kind of remember exactly what it is that I've done for the most part, because, you know, part of the emotional sustainability of doing illustration is kind of just really relinquishing it as soon as it's done.
Oh yeah, for sure. It makes me think.
Think what?
Do you understand what makes a good art director? Because,
well, that's
it's a funny job. Have you ever done it?
No, I haven't. And when you asked me if I wanted to chat with you for this show, Vinny's was the one that I listened to.
Yeah,
because he'd mentioned when he'd done it, but I hadn't listened to it at the time. And obviously, he does art direction. And
correct.
You posed the same question to him, and it was funny because, like, his take on it was kind of making the right choice for the artist, and then kind of getting out of the way.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's him answering kind of very much as an artist, because I feel like, you know, like, I think any time that you're making a piece of art for somebody, and maybe the art director is pushing you in a different direction, your ego is like, oh, well, they chose me, so they should just like anything that I do. Which, you know, I feel like we all have those thoughts, and sometimes I think is relatively justified. But I do think, I do think art direction is kind of, it's kind of like a pretty esoteric job, because I feel like there are definitely good art directors and there's definitely bad art directors. And I think the difference between the two is pretty subtle.
Oh yeah. That's actually the funny part to me. I think I do what's considered comparable to art direction sometimes,
yeah. But
I can't imagine someone trying to do it who doesn't make art.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know how common that is. But it's a question I ask largely because when you're young, I don't even know if I had the conception of an art director as a middleman between me and the client. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I certainly was like tight when I first started doing illustration. Like this feeling that, how do I word it? It could just be a personal thing, but you know, your first couple jobs, you are much more aware of what you think you are or what you think they want from you.
Yeah.
And then you make a terrible drawing. At least that's what I did.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm not so certain. It's a funny job. I used to just blanketly denigrate it, but I've tailed that back a bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's important to a job going well, and sometimes a job's just cool and it's an interesting job, and the art direction is not terribly important to its outcome. But then you've encountered it so much, and surely in your head right now you're thinking of the best ones you've dealt with. For me, it's just interesting what characteristics are there, and do you think it requires being an artist?
Pretty
good one.
I don't think it does require being an artist. I mean, I think it does. I think it requires having a certain kind of like visual acuity or kind of like aesthetic acuity. But I don't think you necessarily have to know how to draw in order to successfully engage with drawing or image making on a kind of critical and successful level. And I guess when I think of kind of art directors who I feel kind of like good about, I mean, a lot of them are kind of directors where there was kind of like a longer working relationship. I feel like, you know, when you first work with someone, there's kind of like, you know, you obviously have like very little sense of who the person on the other end, other side of the email is. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely a lot of value in working with someone time and again, and you can kind of, rather than familiarity breeding contempt, I do think the more you work with someone, the kind of better your work for that person gets. I do think that there's kind of, I do think that kind of relational aspect of the job is one of the more kind of rewarding things.
That's fair. It's just a bad question. I'm rethinking.
I don't think
there's not much to it.
I don't think it's a bad question. I think
it's a fairly nebulous like you were saying. It's kind of, it's a little, for whatever reason, it's hard to grasp. And it's partially why I'm interested in it, because I think you say it to most humans and they're just like, I don't actually know what that would entail.
Yeah,
I didn't know what it would entail for a while. And the ones that I liked really were of the ilk that they would just pretty much let me do what I had to do.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think part of, I guess, where I think art direction becomes really valuable is when you know the person a little bit and you kind of have the confidence to kind of maybe send them something that isn't completely 100% finished. You're like, you send them the art and it's like not completely finished in your mind. Like you want to know what their input is, because sometimes they'll be really on board with it, or sometimes they'll be actually have some kind of pretty good feedback. And it's really much more about you're both working together to serve whatever it is the art is for. And I mean, the art really, it's really not for yourself. And like, it can be satisfying to produce, but it's not, you know, the art isn't for me. And right. And the art, and I think when you surrender it being for yourself, I think then it's easier to conceptualize the role of the art director in the process, because the art director is there to kind of help you make the thing that needs to be made to accompany whatever the hell it is that you're working for, whether it's like some like incredibly shallow commercial thing or some misguided political thing or something, maybe even that you have some belief in. Ultimately, you know, I think the art director helps you understand what the hell it is the thing that you're trying to do is supposed to do. And why it is you're getting paid $600 to do it.
So that's the rate? That's what it's at right now?
That's about where the New York Times is.
Nice. I think it was that. Maybe it's because I was, it was just about me, but no, I think I was like 300 10 years ago or something.
Yeah, it was. There was kind of, I don't know, I mean, you were probably aware, but I think it was last year, there was some illustrators were kind of doing a mild revolt around pricing, and I do feel like the Times is actually a little responsive around that.
No, I'm very ignorant. I didn't know about that, but that's not bad. 600.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely helps.
You know, maybe it's as like a conductor. When I watch a conductor.
Yeah,
not knowing much about any of that, I feel the same way.
I mean, I think
what that, are you?
I mean, I think that's a very universal experience. Me and my girlfriend went to the Philharmonic the other month, and I mean, we were a little stoned. But you do like the performance wouldn't happen without that guy there. But what the fuck is he doing? Like, you know,
that's how I feel. Yeah, about it. That's where I come down.
It's, you know, a ship has a figurehead. And the orchestra has the conductor. And I do think there's kind of like a, to what, you know, conductors, please don't email me denigrating me. I believe that there's an art to what you do. But the, I'm
open to it if they want to.
But I also, I think there's just a lot of kind of like, when a lot of people are doing something, I think them having the ability to kind of like train their psychic energy on one person, I think just helps, you know. Maybe everyone knows what the fuck they're supposed to be doing, but having one person to look at while you're doing that thing, when you have 200 people involved, I think helps it get done. I think it's just kind of like a pretty basic kind of like requirement for a leader.
Fair enough. It's true. It's like a scapegoat in reverse or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe it is, maybe the scapegoat is the conductor. I don't know. I don't know when it goes wrong who they blame, but he probably blames others. That's my guess.
I mean, he also gets like a very, very large round of applause.
It's true.
You know, he's kind of like the mascot slash high priest slash totem slash figurehead for the whole enterprise. For any concert violinists out there listening, please confirm whether the delineation between a good conductor or a bad conductor is a slim one or a wide margin.
I'm going to assume it's a wide margin there, but slim for art direction. That's my where I'm coming down on both. Could be wrong. But are you enthralled, excited, galvanized, revitalized about anything? Any project? I know the music.
Yeah.
I like this. Are you touring? What's going on?
One of the bands that I play in, which is called Barely Real, on Monday, which I don't know when anyone's going to be listening to this, but Monday, April 1st, we're going to be putting out some music. And then April 5th, we're going to be playing a show in Brooklyn, which is...
How many bands are you in right
exciting.
Now?
Two. I mean, there's one that's a band, and then there's another that's kind of has been a band in the past, but is currently more of kind of like a self-recording project.
What are you spending, like, percentage-wise when you break it down?
Time-wise, you mean?
Yeah. Just.
I mean, I don't know. It depends. I mean, like, for the last couple of weeks, I've just been having to work pretty hard, and I really haven't had much time for music. But other times, you know, it's what I'll be spending most of the week doing.
Do you listen to your own music when you draw?
I mean, when I'm mixing stuff, I do listen to it quite a lot because you're like, I don't know, you're listening, I don't know, you have to kind of listen to it in order to kind of like hear what you want to improve about it. And there's like a satisfaction in hearing things that you think are good, and then you get very consumed in what's not working and how you might improve that or change that. So that does involve a lot of listening. But I mean, a lot of the time when I draw, I either kind of like got like some YouTube documentary about hobos on in the background, or I'm listening to WFMU.
Hmm. Do you feel better about the music you make or the drawings you make?
I feel good about both, I think. I think there was a period a couple of years ago where I felt more actively kind of disillusioned and like I was struggling with the contradictions and compromise of drawing for a living.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to kind of release a lot of that angst and just let it be what it was. And making music, I think, was a big part of being able to kind of have it play a certain role and not anything more than that.
Well, I'm certain it's still one of the best things you can do for a living. after surveying the many things humans do to live.
Yeah.
It's very special. It's very rare.
Yeah.
Even though many may try, I think artists often forget because they're often around other artists, etc.
That's true.
Many people, imagine trying to be what you are and failing. Imagine trying to be an illustrator and failing.
Yeah, I mean, that's too that's too depressing to even contemplate.
Well, I think many have, and yeah, I think it's a cool thing to do for money. I mean, most people don't even know what it is sometimes. There's people who just legitimately...
Yeah,
and I mean, say, yeah, and, I do illustration for money. What?
Yeah, and God bless them.
But, yeah, they avoided it. Yeah,
yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I definitely don't want to. I do think that the whatever kind of internal sort of process that you have to go through to kind of accept the contradictions of whatever you do for a living, especially art, I think can make the way you talk about it sound to someone who doesn't do that for a living sound kind of like maybe even conceited or unaware of your fortune as a person. But at the same time, there's also the other side where people's perception that, you know, you're lucky to be doing something for a living means that you shouldn't get paid for it, you know, and that sort of thing. But
yeah, that's a tough one to explain to people.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I do like it. I feel like it very much suits who I am as a person, and you know, the years that I had to spend you know, working in retail and stuff and doing other jobs on the side, and you know, I was tremendously much more unhappy and it really is a huge pleasure to be able to make art for people. And it's also psychologically healthy to know that art isn't for myself, and there is a lot of satisfaction in making it. And there's also a lot of satisfaction to kind of leaving it where it is. And when I first moved to New York and I was first starting out in illustration, more of my friends were illustrators. That was like more of the circle that I was in, and it made up more of my world. And I think, you know, I mean, I think it's true of anything that you do when you're young. You are kind of supposed to be subsumed in it, but I do think that the more variety you have in your mental and emotional and life, the happier you are and the more kind of productive you're going to be.
It's true. It seems paradoxical, but the truth is, I think there's chapters and phases that are quite natural to go through, and you can't go back. And
no, you can't.
You wouldn't want to. Yeah. And the realization that this vocation is a part of a very large and complex puzzle, as opposed to being the central focus, I think about a decade in, it almost always happens. And yeah, if it doesn't, I think it approaches like it's a demon. It can consume you in a very dark way. And I think we often forget how slow life actually is. When we look at prolific artists of the past, they weren't existing in the same kind of attention span. And so, you know, I feel like by the end of this generation's, like the artists in this generation, they're going to have made far more paintings than someone 100 years ago. And there's just this speed that is pretty wild, and one does not need to do that by any means.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I feel like, you know, when you're young, when you look at kind of people in the arts who are maybe just a year or two older than you, you're like, how the fuck did they produce this by the time they were my age? You know, like how, yeah, you know, how did, like, you know, what, like Rambo die when he was like 21 or something, or like, you know, like, you know, any kind of like teen wunderkind or someone who like flamed out at 27 and left behind like some body of work that people are still obsessing about. But I'm reading a book at the moment called The Rest Is Just Noise, which is about classical music in the 20th century. It's by Alex Ross. It's really good. And it's kind of, it's just telling the story of like all like the simultaneous movements and developments and kind of like political and social context for classical music in the 20th century. And yeah, I mean, like, that, you know, they're talking about like the careers of composers, and, you know, in like a couple paragraphs you go from like 1901 to like 1922, and like that person's best work is still ahead of them. Right. And you know, I think the 20th century, like definitely the second half of it especially, there was an extreme fetishization of youth and like the cultural production of youth. But then a lot of those same people are still alive and still making records. I mean, like Kim Gordon's making kind of like music that kind of sounds like Young Lean. And, you know, I feel like the kind of, I hope that we're coming to more of a sense generally the age cap on your creative worth as a human being isn't that low.
Sure. I mean, especially as a drawer.
Yeah.
Drawers have never had this issue because they've never been that sought after.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're not painters.
Yeah.
That's a different set of problems. But that's interesting. I should look into that book. It sounds like a interesting read.
It is. It's really good. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, part of what's interesting about it is that it doesn't really prize one strain of development as being inherently more modern than any other. So, you know, like, it's not like I feel like it kind of, which, you know, when you're talking about like Schoenberg and like 12 tone music and that sort of thing, like, you know, he was obsessed with his conviction that his music was, and like the atonality and dissonance of his music was like the most logical, had to be the next step in the development of modern music, that it was inevitable. But in actuality, it was his choice to make that music. And like his choice to do so was a contemporaneous choice with the choices of other people who were like looking to the past or kind of developing in other ways. And I don't know. I think you'd especially like it because it does kind of, I think, give context to these utopian moments and kind of moments of extreme conviction, and then kind of move the globe slightly and show you what else was happening. And I don't know. It's like very, you know, us. In terms of the
art,
sorry, I'm beginning to waffle a little bit, as is known to happen.
Well, let's end it on a, you may find it a strange proposition, but I've never been to England. Can you make me want to go to England? I want to go to England. It's cheap to get to London.
It's right there, you know?
It's not cheap.
And I remember there was a time where it was like 150 or something.
Oh my God, absolutely.
It's going to be a long time ago.
I mean, I think that was 1,000 years ago, perhaps. It's not cheap.
Okay, it's not cheap, but what? I know there's something there.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Even if it's personal, I want to understand the.
I mean, you're talking to an English person, but that's precisely why you're talking to the wrong person.
Yeah. That makes sense. I got you.
Oh no. I mean, I think, you know, we've been talking about all this stuff, and I think, my brain is, several buildings over from the, let's go to England brain.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, when you're contemplating a problem and you realize that it's going to take you, 7 minutes to claw your way over to it.
No, I don't think we have the same kind of brains. Well, yours is like a city, apparently.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty probably apt for a lot of the shit that I draw.
You know, I've never considered that anything in my brain is urban looking. That there's thoughts in other buildings.
Well, now we're back to the bricks.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, those are the ridges in my brain. It's just brick pattern.
Fair enough. I can accept that you have no answer. But I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
we'll cross paths again someday.
I'm sure.
Enjoy.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Music by Dori Bavarsky and Mingja Chen. Next up, we have Gary Bodker. Have a good week. Hey,